Welcome to Exagility. I'm your host, John Coleman. Alan Kelly, author of Succeeding with OKRs in Agile. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, John. And yourself?
Really good. I read your most recent book, the 2023 version. I believe you had an earlier version. I think it was might have been 2019 or something like that. Really enjoyed reading your book. And there are lots of different opinions about OKRs and how you do it and all that. And I was actually really inspired by the way you handle it. And I'm really looking forward to going through it today with you.
I'm looking forward to explaining my view of the world.
Lovely. Yeah, looking forward to it, Alan. It makes the world go around, all these different opinions and some bit of sanity as well in the world of OKRs. So I'm curious, though, Alan, how you even got into this OKR land in the first place. Well, how did you fall into this place where you ended up writing the book about it?
How far back do I go? You know, back in the day, I was a hardcore C++ programmer. I loved nothing better than being left alone to hack out some groovy C++. But I got to this point where the code wasn't a problem anymore. I could make the machines do whatever I wanted them to. I could make it work. And I tried going to Silicon Valley for a bit, and I came back and I still did the same thing. And so I consciously kind of moved myself to the dark side, to more of the managerial side, the people who wear shirts and ties, product managers and all that. And, you know, most of their frustrations are the same as programmers. You know, they're not that different, really. And about the time I was doing that, Agile had come along. And so I joined in with the Agile stuff, and it made sense to me. I'd done similar things when I was still coding, although we didn't call it Agile then. And so for a few years, I was really into Agile coaching, training, all of that. And then shortly before the pandemic, I was working with a client and I was coaching some teams. And we came back after Christmas, and there was an edict from management, thou should use OKRs. And it was a bit like that Dilbert cartoon. That was the training. Thou shalt use OKRs. And like me and the other Agile coaches, like scratching our heads. And we're like, well, we all know what OKRs are. We've all been to a few conference presentations. Have we used them in anger? Well, not really. And actually, it was a great bit of self-training. You know, we were all bouncing these around and trying things. And, you know, I realized pretty quickly that there's an interpretation here which aligns perfectly with Agile. And if you take that interpretation, they're much easier to work with, and they just continue the Agile agenda. And then I start to make some notes about these things. I start to write things down. And partly I write to learn myself. I learn a lot when I write. I make sense of the world. I'm trying to organize my thoughts. And so I was writing some notes. Pandemic hits. And so the book becomes my pandemic project for the first few months. How long can it last? It's only going to be a few weeks, isn't it? Well, it lasted long enough for me to write a book, didn't it? And it's fantastic. The response I've had from the book, you know, I've done presentations, I've spoken to people, I've helped some companies, and my learning journey has continued, and it just gets richer and richer. So that's where I got to where I am today.
That's really cool. There is a danger, isn't there, with OKRs? And so what I'm hoping to cover with you today is how you can make sure that we implement them in a healthy and helpful way, because done badly, they can end up being like management by objectives, just relabeled, can't they?
Yeah, and I think that's a key thing to think about, because there's a reason the world moved away from management by objectives. And originally, OKRs were a bit of a reinvention of management by objectives. And if you read some of the older OKR works, you can kind of see that. And there's one way of working with the older OKR texts. But most of those texts come out of OKRs at Intel in the 1970s. And I guarantee you, none of your listeners work in the 1970s. And few of your listeners work at Intel. Today is 2023. The world has moved on. Most notably, we have Agile, and the world has become digital, and OKRs have had to evolve, and some places have evolved them more, and some places cling to that old understanding, and some people pick up an old book and say, oh, it says this. Like any technique, you know, if it's going to be useful, you have to modify it, and you have to make it your own, and you have to evolve it with time. So I think when I first published my book, I was kind of expecting people to say to me, hang on, you're contradicting somebody else. You're contradicting a greater authority. And on the whole, that hasn't happened. And what I've realized is most of the latter-day Agile coaches accept that OKRs in 2023 are not the same as OKRs in 1975.
Yeah, agreed. In fact, one of the things I noticed when I was studying John Doerr's work is I found some old-fashioned ideas in there, which we'll maybe touch on during this interview. But before we get into OKRs, one of the things that the whatmatters.com people say about objectives and key results is you need to kind of put them on a bedrock of a really good mission or purpose. And they don't really go into, you know, how you do that. And they don't go into how you get good leadership to enable all this. And all. They're just saying, you know, you need good leadership. You need a mission or purpose. And you need to sit on top of that. And then there's the strategy. Roger Allen Martin talks about strategy, for example. And he's kind of basing a lot of his work on Steve Porter's Five Forces and so on. And then you've got Rumeld with good strategy, bad strategy. You've got all sorts of work going on there. And then you've got strategy deployment. You've got Carl Scotland with his agile strategy deployment. You've got the flight levels people know with the level 3 flight levels. You've got Dave Snowden with his S-Train mapping. It's like becoming a big almost alphabet soup of like, where do you start? When you want to do OKRs, you got strategy deployment, mission, purpose. What's your view of the world, Alan? Where would you start?
Yeah, I'd start where you are. Because, you know, look, of course, it's going to work better if you've got a clear vision, you've got a clear purpose, you've got a defined strategy, if you can map out your strategy deployment, and you can, of course, it's going to work really well if you do that. But how many of you are in a position to do that now? And how many of you in your organization are positioned to say, excuse me, CEO, 5-6 layers above me, you have not articulated the strategy clearly enough. We don't know what to do. So if we don't do it because we don't have a clear strategy, what we're going to do is sit there and twiddle our thumbs and wait for the day when the strategy and the purpose is clear and the strategy deployment has been mapped out. Are we just going to get on and start doing things? And you can also ask, which comes first, the strategy or the actions? So if you look at strategy, there's one school of thought, and you mentioned Porter there. It's the vision of strategy most people start with. The strategy is some sort of plan. And somebody somewhere, be they super brains or consultants, maps out a strategy, and then we execute the strategy, right? Mm. If you look at the strategy literature, there's another view on strategy. And this is strategy is emergent and strategy is learning. And actually, I'm a big fan of the work of Henry Mintzberg, who is like the anti-Porter. He's a professor at McGill University in Canada. Mm. And Mintzberg says strategy is a pattern of behavior. So right off there, everyone who knows about patterns, there's a light bulb going off. And yes, strategy is in part forward defined. You are setting out to achieve something. You plan to go somewhere. But strategy is also retrospective. Strategy also explains where you are today. Strategy helps explain the courses and the decisions you took. And it's by understanding the past and your decisions that you inform the future. So if you take that view, you may be waiting for a strategy for a long time. And actually, I see OKRs as a two-way street. Yes, you are, to some degree, there's a strategy coming down from above. The organization is saying, we want to enter the Chinese market. But at the same time, your team are the people who are working with customers. Your team are probably the team who are working with the technology. You're at the cutting edge. And you're feeding back to management. And you're telling them what's happening in the marketplace. And Andy Grove, the originator of OKRs, has a great story along these lines in his book, Only the Paranoid Survives. And he talks about Intel it was as late as like 1990 or something, I can't remember the year, where the Intel board decided Intel's future was in CPUs. Now, for most listeners, they probably never known Intel as anything but a CPU company. But Intel was founded as a memory company. And Intel, for the first 20 or 30 years of its life, was about memory. And then there was this big strategic decision made by the board to become a CPU company. And so they then go out to tell their managers that we've changed strategy. And the managers are like, yeah, so what? We knew that. The pieces are in place. And actually, on the ground floor, with the engineers designing CPUs and the salesmen making sales, they had already changed the focus to be CPU focused. And all the board was really doing was realize the information they were getting was CPU sell, because people were selling CPUs. And that board decision to pivot was almost a rubber stamping exercise. So strategy is a two-way street, because the people at the top are the people who are most removed from customers.
Yeah, that's very helpful, Alan. Thank you. I think one area as well where OKRs is really helpful is when there's multiple foci. You know, the way a camera has one focus, you try to focus the lens and it's just, I'm just focusing on you, for example. A Toyota Kata, for example, they might have a far-off vision. They don't really talk about that in the four steps. Then you have your challenge, and then you have your target condition, and then you have a where are we right now and what's our baby step to get towards the target condition. And there, but they have one direction of travel. But a lot of the companies I work with, they've got people with multiple objectives, and maybe that's where OKRs help. But what matters, people are saying, is maybe each individual, I'm not saying you have individual OKRs, but within your footprint, that you're subjected to maybe 1 to 3 objectives and 3 to 5 key results per objective. Whereas the radical focus people are saying, well, you should really be subjected to or contribute to or co-create one objective each which has 3 key results. What's your position on this, Alan?
I would love it if I ever meet anyone who has one objective. I think that's a great thing to aspire to. And I'm all for working towards one objective. And, we have full throttle on one objective. But that's not the world I encounter, and it's not the world I see in my clients. I'm more likely to have a client who says, oh, last year we set 18 OKRs. We set 23 OKRs. That is ridiculous. For me, if you need more than the fingers of one hand, you've got work to do. Now, once you've throttled the 18 down to 4, we don't need to stop. We can keep on reducing it. Maybe one day we'll get one. But the truth is, anything but the smallest organization is trying to do multiple things at one time. And in even the smallest organizations, they may only be trying to do one thing, but because they're small, the resource constraints mean that people have to do multiple things. So I think it's a great ambition to work towards one. But again, you can't wait for this precondition to be satisfied before getting started. You'll never get there if you wait for it.
Indeed. One of the things that I struggle with, though, I do Scrum training, I do Kanban training, I do Lean UX and all sorts. But within the Scrum world in particular, the whole notion of commitment is really, if I put it in my own words, is more about doing your best. So even if there's a sprint goal, for example, a team commits to a sprint goal, they're going to do their best to achieve a particular objective within a sprint. Yeah. They're going to use that as their little North Star for the sprint on the way towards their product goal or whatever. And their product goal is their direction. That's what they're trying to follow since 2020. That's what they're trying to do. But it's quite possible, because the work deals with complexity, that there's some stuff we don't know. Some stuff will emerge, as you mentioned. You mentioned emergence. And so it's not the end of the world if the team discovers that can't actually deliver on that goal this sprint, but that maybe hopefully they'll try to find a way to simplify how to achieve the goal, but ultimately sometimes they struggle to deliver it. And so the notion of commitment isn't as hard in relation to the goals in Scrum. The commitment is really more about a quality. They have this definition of done. You could argue Kanban has a quality as well through the columns in your board. You might have exit criteria for a card to move from one column to the next, and that's how you establish quality. And so building something is expensive, and where the higher order commitment is usually quality. And sometimes you'll make trade-offs. You'll take on some technical debt as a competitive advantage, and you you have to pay that back later. You're doing that consciously. But my struggle, Alan, is that teams using Scrum, for example, if they're planning for this sprint, let's say, and they got the sprint for the sprint, they don't actually know what they're going to do the next sprint, or the sprint after that, or the sprint after that. And so when people plan like quarterly key results, for example, supporting some objective, I don't know how they can commit to those, because what I'm reading from the What Matters people is that, and from a lot of people other than yourself about OKRs, is that when you have a committed key result in OKR land, you need to move mountains. You said you'd do it, so why didn't you do it? So what are we doing to make it happen? They also have aspirational OKRs, but I don't hear many people talking about those. I'd love to get your perspective on how we deal with this whole commitment thing.
John, you've really opened a complete can of worms here.
Yeah.
And you're right, both OKRs and Scrum have this idea of people moving mountains. And yeah. I love the idea. I always remember Ronnie Reagan, you know, win one for the Gipper, get out there and win that match. And I want that to happen. But actually, that is asking a lot of people. I've eliminated the word commitment from my vocabulary for this very reason, because the use of the word commitment for people who are in a position of authority, it's become like a stick to use against the staff to say, you said you were committed to this. And for the people who do the work, commitment has become kind of, this is the stuff we're going to try and do. The word commitment has become devalued. And really, Scrum can't solve this. OKRs can't solve this. It actually harks back for me to General George S. Patton. And he said, there's a great deal of talk about loyalty from the bottom to the top, meeting your commitments. And he continues, he says, loyalty from the top is more necessary and less prevalent. So if you as a team are going to move mountains, I hope that the people who control the budget, the people who have to say whether they order pizzas in, are also committed. And really under this, it's not just a commitment of, you know, other people, it's psychological safety. And in many organizations, we don't have the safety for people to challenge. When people, you become committed, okay, I'll commit to it, but I don't really believe in it, but I'm not going to voice my concerns. I'm not going to say why I think this works. It's easier to keep my mouth shut, go through the motions, and when we fail to hit the target, well, we always fail to hit the target. And so commitment gets devalued even more.
Yeah. Yeah, so your line really would be to de-emphasize the whole notion of committed OKRs, and it's
it's really
more aspirational, being honest, isn't it?
It's aspirational. I think in the book, I talk about aspirational OKRs. And in a lot of the OKR literature, they push this line that if we just shoot for the moon, we'll get more than if we shoot for low Earth orbit, even if we miss the moon. And I love the idea, and it's great. And sometimes you want to do that, but you can only do that with psychological safety, right? Where that is lacking, where you're lacking experience, then I say use utility OKRs. Set OKRs. Don't feel as though you have to be aspirational, but just get some practice in with doing OKRs. Use them as a management principle. And maybe with time, you can start to build the aspirational thing in. One thing that I always remember when we talk about aspirational OKRs is a few years ago, I was coaching a team through OKRs and Agile. And we got to quarter setting of OKRs. And we had a call and we told the other team, the OKRs we were intending to deliver, because this other team used our stuff. And we got to the end of the OKR briefing and they said, and can you tell us, which of these OKRs are you sure and certain to meet? And we said, well, we've been told to use the Google criteria 70%, be aspirational. It doesn't matter if we fail, be 70%. And they're like, what do you mean 70%? If these aren't 100% committed, if we aren't going to get all of this, then don't waste our time. And the truth is, while we talk about aspirations and shooting for the moon, in many organizations, what people want is predictability. And if your team is being aspirational and shooting for the moon, and you're missing sometimes, and other people in the company are more concerned about predictability and knowing for sure what they're going to get, then you're going to have a conflict. So whichever way you use them, make sure you find out what your stakeholders and what your leaders are expecting.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the percentage topic, actually, because the Kinevan guys would be saying, well, you know, OKRs are useful in the complicated space. But I kind of dodged that bullet by saying, well, you could probably use what you're kind of saying there, maybe over 60%, maybe less than 80% achievement of your key results would be kind of a good sweet spot. Because if you're heading over 80, you're closer to 100, you might be sandbagging, you might be picking really easy ones and just kind of claiming victory. And if you're kind of lower than maybe 60% for complicated stuff, you kind of wonder what's going on. Well, with complex stuff, it gets a bit more tricky because a lot of the stuff we're doing, particularly if we're doing discovery, we're going to talk very soon about experiments and hypotheses, particularly when you're doing discovery, actually, we don't know what we're going to learn. You know what I mean?
No. And yeah, I think when you're finishing your OKRs and when you're looking back and evaluating, was this a good quarter or a bad quarter? I don't really care which OKRs you hit and you missed. What I'm concerned about is, did you deliver benefit to somebody who's like a customer? And what did you learn? They're my criteria. Did the team advance? Did the customers advance? And hopefully they go together, they're not always. And I will not put a firm number on this. So one of the strengths of OKRs is we get hard numbers and they make life difficult. But there comes a time when numbers become a problem. And what if you put a hard number on this, you will get gaming behavior. And people will meet the numbers and they will meet them in unusual ways. It's a well-documented phenomenon in economics and in psychology called goal displacement, or Goodhart's Law, if you want to look it up. And I don't know, John, if you like me, live in England, and you probably remember, it's making us a shock to some of your international readers, a few years ago where hospitals were given a target of 48 hours to treat people. And hospitals met this target, and they met it quite inventively, including people being discharged at the 47-hour mark, held in the car park for an hour, and readmitted for another 47 hours. And if we set hard targets, people are very clever. They will find ways of meeting the targets, particularly if you link bonuses and pay to those targets.
Yeah, that's a key thing, isn't it? Separating performance management from the whole OKR framework, basically. Yeah, and actually, I like what you're saying there, because the Lean UX people as well, they talk about having data-informed decision-making rather than data-driven decision-making. And if you're just basing it on the numbers, I like those questions you asked, actually. Did the team advance? Did the customer advance? You also mentioned in your book as well, you talked about test-driven OKRs, which I quite like. I heard of test-driven development, and so some listeners might have heard of that, so you might need to explain that. But also the whole idea of hypotheses and experiments. In fact, I also talk about, instead of going with objectives and key results, maybe objectives and key experiments, you might say hypotheses and key experiments. Mm-hmm. Love to hear more about this topic, Alan.
Yeah, so for those who haven't come across it, TDD, test-driven development, is one of the original agile practices. And it originally started life at the code level. And it means a programmer needs to write some functionality. And before they write any code, they sit down, probably with a tester, maybe with a product owner. They scratch their heads and they write out some tests that the code has to pass to be considered. And they might do it at a micro level themselves with a unit test. They might do it at an acceptance test level with other people. And actually thinking through the tests, the parameters this thing has to meet, is actually a design exploration. You're exploring the space. And it also gives you stopping criteria. Because it's very easy at the code level and other levels to say, I'll do something. Oh, okay, I've got something that kind of works. But, okay, you either shunt it in and say, okay, I accept it's crummy and we'll need to tidy up another day. Or the opposite, you say, it's not quite beautiful enough. I'm going to make it prettier. I'm going to redesign it. I'm going to improve the performance. And you can keep improving it. So TDD, by setting the tests to start off with, it gives you a stopping criteria. And the same thing is seen with acceptance test-driven development and behavior test-driven development. And if you look at what OKRs really are, it's the same idea. Here is our objective. Here is our outcome. Or here is a hypothesis about something we think will make the world a better place. And we are defining that. We are scoping it. We're bounding it by saying, these are the tests we will apply to it. This is what we expect to change in the world. If we meet our objective, create our outcome, if the hypothesis holds up, these key tests will be true. And so you've actually created a form of test-driven management. And I think if OKRs didn't exist already, the Agile community would have had to invent them, because it's the same principle. Tell me what you're trying to do. Tell me what you think is true. Tell me how you're going to change the world. Tell me how you're going to measure it. Now try your hardest to do it. And when we meet those tests or we run out of time, we'll stop and evaluate.
Yeah, that sounds really good. Can you give me some examples, Alan, of some of those objectives and key results, and maybe one where you kind of twisted it maybe into a hypothesis and an experiment?
Yeah, so when you're doing OKRs, you're always kind of making assumptions. So you are saying, so your objective might be, we want to stop hacking attempts. We want to stop cyber breaches. Our objective is to reduce the number of attacks we have on our systems. And our hypothesis is that if we beef the system up, if we update our libraries, if we close some security holes, if we move to an HTTPS server, then we will block off some of the avenues of attack. And if we block off the avenues of attack, then we will actually reduce the number of attacks. Now, it could be you're such a juicy target that when you block off those avenues, the hackers find another avenue. But until you try to do that, you're not going to know that. So you have to make some assumptions. You have to formulate a hypothesis and say, this is what we're going to try and do. And we think this will lead to this given outcome. Making sense?
Makes a lot of sense. And you also talked as well about operational OKRs, which I really like, because what matters people, they're saying you should leave out your BAU, business as usual, objects and key results. It should all be about improvements and so on. But actually, yeah, you could have improvement operations as well. And also what I don't like about leaving out BAU is that you end up kind of ignoring the stuff that's keeping the lights on. Hayden Shackleton, he died a couple of years ago, but the year before he died, he told me where I have an experience where he went into a company and he did the biggest, this is when we were back in the office, probably 4 or 5 years ago, and he found the biggest wall he could find and he got them to put a Kanban board of all the objectives in the company and all that kind of stuff and see where things were. And then there was the bottom of the wall. I think Finn Goulding was involved with this as well. And the executives were coming in, they were kind of curious, like, what's this thing on the wall? And they're saying, what's that stuff at the bottom of the wall? And I think it was either Finn or Hayden said, yeah, that's the stuff that's keeping the lights on. And they were like,
yeah,
what?
Yeah.
It's like they could see all this stuff keeping the lights on. Because there's a real danger that if you just focus on the improvements, you forget about the stuff you asked about 5 years ago, right?
And John, you know, we have a perfect example of that in this country at the moment. Countrywide, we're speaking at a time when the newspapers are full of the story about rack concrete in schools and concrete in school, which is collapsing. Yeah. And do you know why no other country is having this problem? Because rack is all over the world. It's because no other country has cut the maintenance budget the way Britain has cut the maintenance budget in the last 10 or 15 years. And because we've not been maintaining our concrete, our schools have started to crumble. And now we've got to replace our schools. So this is the whole project thing. You know, people love shiny new things and execs love customer revenue, things going to bring in new business. And that's where we put our company focus. But, you know, again and again, we find that it's not enough to generate new revenue. You need to protect your existing revenue. It's not just new revenue, it's revenue protection. And in the IT world, there's no better example of this than DevOps. In the last few years, we've seen the DevOps movement come forward and you built it, you run it. So the same coders who are building new functionality, next month, they're expected to carry the pager. And if it breaks down, they're going to get called out. Mm. And so I think we have to pay attention to business as usual, keeping the lights on, maintenance, whatever you want to call it. And at the end of the day, it's probably coming out of the same pot of resources. If I've got a team of 5 engineers and I'm expecting them to do DevOps, I'm expecting them to build shiny new things or generate new revenue. But I'm also expecting those 5 engineers to keep the current thing working. And if I say, look, I just can't concentrate on the new stuff. Scrum had the same thing originally, you know, talk about ring fencing the teams. And when you go to more mature businesses, you find that teams have to do multiple things. And even individuals on teams have got responsibilities from previous years. So I would love it if, as Scrum says, as some of the OKR books say, that we can just park business as usual over there and we can let our team do the shiny new stuff and we can fund the two separately. But that's not the world I see. I see teams that have to keep the lights on. And so what I say is, when you're writing your OKRs, acknowledge this. Think of this as a service level agreement, if you like. I'm thinking back to one team I worked with, and they had to stay, the security example I was given before, I was thinking of this team. They had to keep the live system patched and up to date, because if they didn't, you could get hackers coming into this financial institution, and that would not be fun. And so if they didn't do business as usual as upgrading libraries, any new revenue was irrelevant because no one was going to use the system. So it's all coming out of the same pot of resources. So I suggest teams do write an OKR, which is a service level agreement that says, this is what we're going to do to protect the current revenue. Now, to keep the John Doe folks happy, we can call it OKR zero. And when you're talking to people, you can hide it. But I want you to acknowledge it. Otherwise, you get to the end of the quarter and you sit down with your sponsors and they say, why have you not met any of your OKRs? And the reason is you had to prop up the roof. You had to do security fixes. You know, all your customers complained about something. You had real live stuff. And the execs don't see this. And if OKRs are going to be a feedback mechanism throughout the organization, you have to reflect the fact that your people are keeping the lights on and protecting existing revenue.
Yeah, that sounds very sensible. Quite a bit into the book, you talk about an OKR roadmap.
Mm.
And I saw a visual there where there was, this is audio, of course, we have to kind of build a kind of an audio picture almost for the listeners. But there was like, I think I saw four quarters or something, and there was blah, blah, blah stuff was inside there for the various key results that might be kind of going in there. And there was a kind of a piece of a jigsaw puzzle image where this is what we're doing in this particular quarter, and that's how that fits into the overall roadmap. Can you tell us a little bit more about how roadmaps work in your world with OKRs, Alan?
So I'm thinking, you know, before you set your OKRs for the coming quarter, there's going to be some pre-work. And most of this work is going to fall on your product managers, your product owner type people who are going to talk to customers and talk to stakeholders and related teams and find out what needs to be. And so they need to run ahead of the team and sketch this out. But they are also going to be aware of things which are going to need to be done, you know, perhaps before the end of the year. Or they're going to be aware of other teams who are working on things that will need stuff from your team. Maybe not now, maybe not next month, but, you know, in the near future. And so I think it's quite rational to sketch yourself out a roadmap and say, look, here's the three or four things we're working on this quarter. These are the three or four things we're working on that we hope to be working on in the next quarter. But you know what? We're not going to go firm on them until we get to planning for that quarter. And if you want, you can sketch out a few things for the future quarters. There's a limit to how far in the future you go. And you can put that in front of people. So when you're saying, these are the OKRs we're looking at for the next quarter, and they say, but what about entering the Chinese market? You can say, okay, we're not scheduling that for two or three quarters. We haven't forgotten it. It's out there. And these things can always change. You do need some sort of look ahead. We can't be sure about what the world is. But what we can say is, given where we are today and what we know today, this is the way we imagine the world going. Now, if in 6 months' time there's shots over Taiwan, maybe we're not entering China and we don't need to do that. We can change it. So I want to be firm on this, but I think you can sketch a roadmap into the future of the kind of things you expect to be working on.
Yeah, I do a lot of roadmapping, and I teach people about roadmapping techniques as well. And there's one roadmapping technique that I really like, which is now, next, later. It's very vague.
Yeah.
And then there's the kind of what you have, which is you got your quarters laid out, and which works really well when the management and leadership team that you're working with, they all know that can change because it's not hard. It's not set in stone. And I remember, you remind me of years ago when, in 2016, actually, I was in a credit card company. And they wanted a clear plan about everything that was going to happen, you know, in the next 2 years.
Yep.
And they were really pushing me hard on this one. They were really pushing me.
And you know, so John, I'd like a clear plan in the next 2 years. I'd like to know exactly when Keir Starmer is going to be prime minister. I want to know how big Joe Biden's majority is going to be. I want to know when Putin's going to pull out. I want this clear plan. Yeah, why can't I have it?
Exactly, yeah. You know what? I just dodged the bullet. I did a transformation map, right? So I had, this is what we're doing this quarter. So, okay, it's September, the time of the recording. Yeah. This is what we're doing this quarter by the end of October. This is what we think we're doing the next quarter. This is what we're doing in H1 2024. This is what we're doing in H2 2024. This is what we're doing in 2025, 2026. So the time horizon was getting more vague as it went out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Actually, when I look back, that did actually happen because it was just so wide, you know, it was going to fit within there anyway.
You know what? I shouldn't say this, should I? But I've kind of given up on roadmaps. I kind of just close my eyes because the roadmaps you'll most want are those with estimates on. And the further into the future you look, the more wild your estimates are going to be. Yeah. And I also know that no matter what the roadmap is today, no matter how much you swear and how much blood you spill on it, in 6 months' time, it will be discarded if there's more money on the table for something else, or, you know, priorities will change. So all a roadmap is a version of how the world could unfold. And the only thing I know for certain is it won't happen like that.
Yeah, yeah. No, totally. Yeah. And I think as long as people know that whatever you're showing in front of them, I love a guy from Romania gave me this one-liner that I use all the time now. So whatever tool I use, I'd say, and I'll give you a better forecast next week.
Yeah.
And I will, because it'll be better. It will have more information, it will have more learnings. And I basically said in a very nice way, I don't know, actually. I've no clue what's going to happen.
Let me tell you a story. Years ago, I was working at a well-known travel retailer, and I was coaching these teams. And the project manager came to me one day and he said, can you tell me when the team will be done with this project? I said, no. Yeah. He said, what you have to tell me. I said, I've got no data to base a forecast on. This team has only just started working agile. I've got no data I can use. He says, but we have to know a date when you'll be done so that we can issue the redundancy notices. And I said, will you tell me what date you'd like us to be finished and we'll bring it into that date? He says, no. I need to know when you'll be finished. I can't tell you that. I need to have some parameters here. And we ran around the circle of this for like 20 minutes. And he just wouldn't accept it. I almost got myself fired refusing to give an answer.
Yeah, yeah. It's tricky, isn't it? It's very tricky. And by the way, you just reminded me of slack time. I'm not talking about the communications tool. I'm talking about, you know, giving people a bit of free time.
Yeah.
And I think you know Chris Matz as well. And I believe when he was at Skype before they were taken over by Microsoft, he did something very smart there, which was because when you have multiple teams working together, let's say you're on your team and I'm on my team, the worst thing we can do is the two of us fill our capacity because I'm not able to help you, you're not able to help me. So what he created slack time. So, and he actually, what he did was he asked teams to plan for 50% of their capacity, which like sets people into a panic sometimes when you tell them that. But actually, it's kind of weird. You plan for 50%, but they get more stuff done because now I've got time to help you, you got time to help me. I've got time to think, I've got time to question the questions, question the assumptions, even invent stuff. Things like that. Yeah. This is what I worry about OKRs, that if there were like 18 OKRs, Alan, I mean, you shouldn't
be
there. So what have you seen? I mean, good examples and bad examples, I guess.
So my rule of thumb is three OKRs. Three OKRs. You have one major one, you have one minor one, you have one for the team, for tech debt or whatever it is the team want to go after. And if you bend my arm really hard, I'll put in a fourth BAU one. But really, beyond that, And when you do that, I want you to prioritize these. And even in Scrum, I want you to prioritize the work. Because I think what's important is we have sheddable work. We can try and do an awful lot of work, but we need to recognize that not all of it will get done. And if you list it from top to bottom, you have to be prepared for the bottom items to drop off. And I'd much rather they were the low priorities, which the business had set, and not the priorities that whoever's hands are on the keyboard today has decided to be. And Chris is quite right in this about leaving some slack time. Because you know, John, and many of listeners will know, it actually all boils down to queuing theory, you know, and how work gets done. And if you look at queuing theory, and you look at the models on queuing theory, then you're looking about 76% utilization before you start to get queues building up. And, you know, the best example I know of this is my local airport, Heathrow. Have you ever landed at Heathrow and the pilot does not come over and say, it's rather busy at Heathrow today. We're going to fly around in circles for half an hour. Because Heathrow runs at 98% utilization. It's not about 100% utilization. What it is when you get some variability, when you get a plane that has to abort a landing, when you get difficulty turning up, that creates problems. And if you're packed full, the ripple effects create delays. So if you want predictability, you've got to go for a lower number. Now, Chris was using 50% at Skype, which was probably the right number for them. But, you know, everywhere's going to be a bit different.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. I do love the idea. And it does freak people out. But actually, when they see then that they're focusing, finishing, and feeding as well at the right time, they actually end up getting more work done, even though, in other words, they're not spinning the plates all over the place. Do you know what I mean? Trying to get everything done and no one's
this goes back to what we were saying before, to the idea of commitment and this idea that some people seem to believe that teams are not doing their best. And it's only by getting them to promise to do commitment or by overloading them 150% that you can get something out of them. And that's fundamentally a lack of trust. When you start to trust a team, when a team starts to deliver, you start to find, you know, you can get more meaningful commitment, but you get lower utilization rates. And it's a trade-off. What do you want? Do you want the predictability of something being delivered when you said it would be? Or do you want people just trying to shovel as much stuff as possible? But you can't have both.
Yeah, it's true. And in the UK's National Health Service, the NHS for short, there's this concept of moral injury now where doctors are not getting enough time of patients because they're hired by agencies who are contracted to the NHS to see more patients, and they're only allowed to see the patients for 15 minutes or whatever. And that means that the quality of service that the patient is getting is not the right standard. And the irony is, to actually reduce unit costs of the visit and so on, they're actually increasing long-term costs because that patient's going to come back in next week because we didn't deal with them today.
This is one of the dangers with numbers I was alluding to before, that we can set our numbers and we can use our numbers, but if we pursue them too aggressively, if we focus too much on the numbers, so numbers are a great technique in OKRs and elsewhere for keeping you honest and giving you things to work towards. But if you enforce them too rigidly, people react to them and you get these unintended consequences.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds like the truth to me as well. That's kind of what I'm experiencing, what I'm seeing. And I'm hoping when people read your book that they'll realize actually that there are better ways to do objectives and key results, that you can be balanced. You can balance your business as usual, your continuous improvement of business as usual, and any investment initiatives that you're doing. You can keep an eye on all of those. You can be authentic to agility, not maybe drive home commitment too hard, and maybe take a test-driven approach, as you put it, using policies and experiments to let the strategy emerge and to learn. And that all sounds really, really sensible to me.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, John, I'll be honest with you. Back on that day when I received the message, thou shalt use OKRs, I mulled it over for a day or two. And, you know, I could have walked out the door. I knew 101 good reasons why it was going to be a bad idea and why targets were going to mislead us. And I thought, I'll treat this like an experiment. Treat it as an experiment, have a hypothesis, they work, and try them. And as I worked with them, I discovered that you can interpret them as a liberating force, that you can use them to protect the team. You can use them to communicate. You can use them to debug strategy. They are test-driven management. And I think with this interpretation, they sit wonderfully with Agile. But I understand completely why some people look at them and say, it's a return to control, command and control, they're evil. It's all in interpretation.
Yeah, and the other key thing as well, of course, is that we need to knit together the key results as well between the people who are depending on each other, right? So if I'm depending on you to do something this quarter and actually you can't do it this quarter, well, I can't commit either because it just doesn't knit together. So that's a kind of key thing as well. So what I'm curious about, Alan, is what's the key difference between the first edition of your book and the second edition of your book?
So let's say I was not as clear as I should have been in the first edition. I think I sometimes wondered, I made a mistake I see made a lot of people, and I realized that I could be interpreted in a way I rather wouldn't be. And that's it. When it comes to key results, too often, and people see the objective, if I can put it like in Agile terms, they see the objective as an epic, and they see key results as the stories that build that epic. So if we get these Lego bricks we call key results and we assemble them, we'll get the epic, which we call an objective. And what happens when people are setting OKRs is there's a work breakdown going on, that the key results are the tasks that you are going to do to build the objective. And, you know, as we've been talking about test-first management and targeting and so on, acceptance criteria, that doesn't fit in. The work breakdown is a separate activity. So there's a picture in the book where I illustrate this. And I say it's a two-step process. In the first instance, you set your OKRs, what you're trying to do, the outcome you want to create, how you're going to measure that. And then you break. You wait a day or two, at the very least, have a coffee. And then you do your work breakdown. The problem is, when you look at the objective, people fall into the art of the possible. And if that's the objective, how are we going to build it? And they create key results which reflect do X, do Y, do Z. Now, very occasionally that makes sense. But most of the OKRs you look at from teams who are new to this, they are a work breakdown. And I knew, although I talk about test-driven management, things like that in the first edition, I felt there were places where I wasn't as clear as I could be. So that was really the motivation for changing it. And there's other bits and pieces changed. It's a better book, but that was the real key thing.
I found it a really easy book to read, Alan. Congratulations on writing the 2023 version of it. I liked it.
Well, can I tell you, John, one of the reviews that showed up on Amazon a few months after I wrote it, somebody said, it's a great book. I read it in 2.5 hours. And I went to my wife and I said, well, I spent a year writing this book and he read it in 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
And my wife was, hey, that's a compliment, you know. You've got it right if people can read it so fast.
Yeah, because people do want to read things quick. It is one of those books that you can read quickly. I will admit that.
But, thank you.
Yeah, it is. Probably in a couple of sittings, I think people could actually get through it. And there's a lot of really juicy stuff in there. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing more from you, Alan. Where can people find out more about your work, your next experiments?
So I'm very easy. I'm Alan Kelly with 2 L's in the Alan and 2 L's in the Kelly. Don't get me mixed up with the Marriage Guidance Council and the Tank Collector. And my website is just alankelly.net. So you can find a lot of my archive there. I'm on LinkedIn. Please don't connect to me on LinkedIn. Alan Kelly Net is my handle. I've been blogging for years. I recently moved over to Medium for my blog, so you can find me there. You know, if you've got a question, just email me, alan@alankelly.net. I'm often top in Google, so I'm really easy to find. And I'm on Amazon, of course. Several books on Amazon.
Yeah, I'm impossible to find. There's a John Coleman football manager in England who's always about, even if you put in Agile after, he still comes up over me. So yeah, there's a very good football manager teaching Agile apparently in England, so you can check him out. Thanks so much, Alan, for coming on the Extra Journey podcast today.
My pleasure, John. Thanks for having me.
Cheers. Thank you.